From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Having computers in our home and carrying laptops with us when we travel has really become commonplace. What we do with them and what they can do for us is expanding at a phenomenal rate. Today, I'll be speaking with John Dickinson, editor-in-chief of a new monthly magazine called Computer Life, as well as Ruth Stevens, vice president of marketing for Ziff Davis Consumer Media Group. We'll look at their take on what people really need to know. I'll also talk with Barry Cinnamon. He's president and CEO of Allegra New Media, a firm which is producing CD-ROMs, which can interactively teach us about our computers while using our computers. John Dickinson is the editor-in-chief of the new Ziff Davis magazine, Computer Life. Ruth Stevens is the vice president of marketing for Ziff Davis's Consumer Media Group. I had to admit that with all the tech magazines out there, I wasn't sure that we really needed another one. I asked them, what makes Computer Life different?
No other magazine is out there that deals with the kind of products that Computer Life deals with for the sort of audience that Computer Life addresses. That audience is really made up of adult Americans who really use their computers for personal use, and they use products which only address those personal, non-business uses.
So this is in their home?
This is in their home or with them when they travel, but it's in any case personal. The current statistics are that there's over 30 million U.S. homes with personal computers in them. So that's a start. That's a pretty good start, yeah. And, you know, if you take the number apart and you say, well, a lot of those people are running businesses out of their homes, a lot of those people are working at home with the computers, and even if you take a very, very pessimistic estimate, you'll come up with 10, 15 million of them are used for personal use. That's still a pretty nice number.
Now, is this the first magazine of its type?
Realistically, yes. I mean, there's plenty of magazines out there that address specific sub-markets. For example, games is a very big market right now. There's about a dozen magazines out there, including one that we at Ziff Davis own called Computer Gaming World. That addresses a small segment called games. And there are other magazines that address children's software. Mm-hmm. But this is the only one that really addresses just the stuff made for adult people.
Now, you debuted with a paid circulation of more than 300,000. How did you get 300,000 people to subscribe sight unseen?
It's all magic.
Will you do that for me too, please?
Sure. Actually, it's a combination of two things. One is it's a fairly straightforward set of direct marketing techniques that almost any you get all this stuff in the mail all the time. Well, publishing companies do the same stuff. We send you a zillion postcards, and some number of them come back saying, yes, I'll take the offer and take the magazine. And we did have a pretty nice offer. It's an issue free, and there's a premier disc that goes with it, and it's a pretty nice deal. So we got a lot of people to subscribe going in. And plus, we are on a record number of newsstands around the country.
Let's talk about the magazine itself. What can you find out in the magazine?
You can find out really three things. It's very, very simple. You find out what's really interesting to do. One of the things that we found out in our research was that people who have those computers in their home have a set of things that they do. Actually, it's usually a very small set, maybe even only one thing, like pay their bills, that they do with their computer. And they're really very, very comfortable doing that. They know exactly what it's all about. They have a level of knowledge that is awesome. They really know a lot about that one particular thing. What concerns them is that they have this machine that is capable of many, many things, and they're aware of that. But they're also aware that learning that new thing is going to take them some time. And like most of us, time is at a premium in most people's lives, including people who own personal computers at home. So before they go out and invest time to learn something new, they want to know what's really going to be worthwhile. So they want to know what to do next. And then they want to know one more important thing, which is, How do they do that? What are the techniques that are involved in actually undertaking that new objective, whether it's a new type of software or adding a piece of hardware to their equipage or whatever? They want to know what the technique is to do that. And then the last thing they want to know is, what products? What are the best products to do that with?
What kind of readers do you think you have? I mean, who are you trying to reach here? Is it the high-techy guys who are sitting in their back dens, you know, adding on obscure little pieces onto their computer?
Just folks. Just ordinary folks who went out and got a computer. And many of them, by the way, got a computer so that they could extend their business day. And they're doing many of the things that they, you know, do at work at home. And they're taking some of those techniques and applying them. But by and large, they're just folks. And they might be an expert at spreadsheets, but they don't know anything about publishing. And so they want to learn more.
Ruth, how do you market a magazine like this? What do you do? Do you just go out there get it everywhere and hope people buy it? Or do you actually find out what people want?
Well, in the magazine business, we have actually two markets. One is people who are interested in the content of the magazine, people like yourself, who have a need for information about computing in their personal lives. And the best way to reach them is through the techniques that John was talking about earlier, which is direct mail or newsstand. And we got the strongest newsstand response that Ziff Davis, which, as you already know, is a very powerful and successful magazine publisher in the first place, has ever seen. The second big market that we have to think about is our advertisers. That is the people who manufacture hardware, publish software, who want to reach the readers that are interested in the information we're delivering. So when I think about marketing, I think about those two audiences. And what we are doing to attract advertisers, of course, is by publishing a great magazine that people want to read that will then provide a wonderful advertising environment for our advertisers.
Well, I think that's the thing that's so overwhelming to me is that all of a sudden there's a brand new magazine. It is a thick magazine. It's got fabulous ads in it. I learned more about, I think, home computing just by reading the ads.
That is the hallmark of special interest publishing, where the advertising content is as important to the reader almost, excuse me, John, as the as the editorial material, because these people are interested, as John explained, in the ideas, the techniques, and the products that will help them use computing to enrich their personal lives.
What's key to what you said is that you learned from the advertising, and if you go to some other type of magazine that's not a special interest magazine, you'll see a product. You'll see a picture of a product. You'll see an image about a product, but you won't learn much about it. But go to a car magazine and read the ad, and you'll learn a lot about cars, or a photo magazine or a skiing magazine. You'll learn a lot.
So one, you're just trying to get an image or a name set out there, and in the other, you're really able to do a lot more selling.
Yeah, actually, it's both. I mean, the fact is that branding and that sort of thing is just as important in the computer business or the ski business as anything else. But in fact, people who are really interested in those products want to know why your brand is important, what makes you better, what makes you more interesting to use.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are John Dickinson, Editor-in-Chief of Computer Life, and Ruth Stevens, Vice President of Marketing for Ziff Davis Consumer Media Group. Now let's talk about some of the people who write for Computer Life. Tell us about them.
Well, they're an interesting combination of people who have written for us at Ziff Davis before and people who come from magazines like Esquire. The thing that was really important, not just for finding writers, but for finding the editors, was to find people who really cared about computers in their own personal life. We want people who, when they come home at night, before they take off their jacket, they flip on their PC. That's really important to us, because if you can't get in there and dig into it at a very personal level, you can't write well or even edit well for the magazine. If you notice when you read Computer Life, you'll see that it's very much written in a style that says, I had this experience. I tried this product out. I did the following couple of things with it. And I'm telling you about it. I'm telling you what that experience was like and what it might mean for you and whether I think it's a good experience or not.
That is true. All the styles had to do, I felt like that person was talking to me. They weren't sitting there writing a third-person review. They were saying, this is my particular bent. And it's not just that. I laughed because I saw that John Carroll wrote the column at the end. And he's a very popular columnist here in San Francisco. And I was surprised to see him in Computer Life. He's just a general columnist. And he says very amusing and insightful things. And here I open it up and I thought, I have to read this. We didn't learn about any new products. You didn't learn about any new, much of any in his research or whatever. You learned about his experience of life. And sort of the new computer life, and that was really wonderful.
And you did learn that computers are funny.
Yes.
Which is something that people don't quite get. And we have a couple of places, actually. We have a column in the front that Gil Schwartz writes called Cyber Cynic. And it is awesomely funny. And it's supposed to be funny. And it's supposed to take a very cynical and funny point of view on what this is all about. I mean, what does it mean to have 30 million computers in homes? That is not a ridiculous idea.
Well, it's funny. I used to run around and say, science isn't funny, you know, and sort of the forefront of the technology nerd jokes are all kind of made up corny jokes. I used to say, it's not funny. But now that technology has become so mainstream, then it's sort of like the essence of humor in life can be infused with the technology, and we finally have it. Technology is funny. We've crossed the line.
Right. Actually, there's another column in here, Scott Rosenberg, another Bay Area writer who you know, I'm sure, from the local paper, is talking about how humor in computer products isn't working so well quite yet. And it's just like the media hasn't, people have not found a good way to use this media to do humor. One of the things you can look at when you look at computer technology is that it's just another media. It's like television, it's like tape, it's like all sorts of things that have happened before. And every media as it has come out has had to find its own way. But of course, they've all started. I can remember watching radio shows on television when television first came out.
And that's right.
That's where they started, and that's where, you know, you look at these interactive things and you're starting to see movies being moved into interactive CD products. And it's interesting. It's not kind of quite there, but it sure is getting there.
You know, when you think about a software product, for example, if you go into a bookstore, you can pick up a book, leaf through it, read the fly leaf, get a feel for whether the contents are appropriate to your needs or whether you're going to enjoy reading it. But in the case of software, not only do they want you to plunk down $60, they want you to make the decision based on just the packaging. And so we think that this magazine will help people decide which products are worth the time and the money.
Now, I don't want to give people the wrong impression here. It wasn't like you guys sat together and said, oh, let's just put this in the magazine. And, you know, wow, 300,000 paid subscription. That doesn't even count what hit the newsstand, the fabulous response. You had to have done something to know that you had the right product here. You had to have done some pre-testing or market testing. What did you do?
We conducted a series of focus groups around the country in April, May. Early part of this year, and found a lot of insight into what information people are looking for and how they want to receive it. And the messages that I took away from those focus groups were that people, as interested in computing as they may be and already aware of its benefits, even the people who are very technical and very knowledgeable describe themselves as intermediates or non-technical, new to it. And what we took away from that is that computing is has so many opportunities that if you know a great deal about one area, there's still a whole lot that you know that you don't know but are interested in finding out more about. We also concluded that people want a voice that speaks to them personally and is relevant to their lives. And I think John and his staff have done a great job of approaching this in an experiential journalism kind of way that, as you said earlier, speaks to you.
John, I want to ask you, how do you bridge the gap between, or the space between, those people who basically know nothing, and I can tell that they get a lot out of this magazine, and those people who really know their stuff? I mean, how do you hit that whole spectrum?
Well, the people who quote-unquote really know their stuff, don't necessarily know about the kind of products that are out there for personal use. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, you know, doing network hub servers and all sorts of stuff like that, whatever I just said.
That, whatever that means.
Right, that wouldn't know how to start Myst at all. Okay, wouldn't know how to play a game, wouldn't know what Flight Simulator was about. And so those people have lots and lots to learn about in here. Plus which, one of the things that we did was put a little technical section in the back. I really shouldn't even call it that because people don't want to hear about technical stuff in a consumer magazine. But
a how-to section.
It's a how-to section, if you will. It's called Just Do It. And the idea there is that these are projects that you can actually undertake. And we always have an advanced project in every issue, and it's called Don't Try This at Home. Which, of course, raises the challenge of trying this at home. And there's stuff in there that people who are out there doing routers and servers and all that stuff haven't probably tried. And because these are advanced consumer products, and they're very technical, there's stuff that people would really have to sort of scratch their head and think about for a while before they actually went ahead and did. We don't really think we have beginners per se, people who know nothing. Because we believe that most of the people who will buy Computer Life already have their computer. They already have some experience on their computer. In fact, in most cases, it's somewhere between 3 and 5 years because they've had experience at work. Please remember that some 75 or 80 million people in this country every day sit down at a desk, and on the other side of that desk is a VC, a tube attached to a computer. So they're very familiar at some level with computers. This sort of fear factor that we used to worry about a lot just isn't there anymore. And it turns out that even if you do have a complete greenie on your hands, they only last about 90 days. And they're not green anymore after 90 days. Their fingers are all nice and browned up and they know what's going on.
Now, is this just PC or is it PC, Mac, whatever's out there?
It's PC and Mac primarily. There's about two-thirds of the products that are in the current issue of Computer Life are either Mac products or run on both platforms. Most of the new multimedia titles run on both a Mac and a PC without worrying about it. You just mount it in one or the other and it'll run just fine. And then the rest are all PC. PC is a dominant platform in this country. It's less expensive for one thing, and there's more software for it of any kind. And of course, that's been true in business for a while, but it's becoming quite true in personal titles as well.
So you're not aligning yourself so much with the hardware. It's a question of what's out there and what life is like.
Yeah, our issues are what you can really get out of your computer. And, you know, we will do Mac-specific and PC-specific stuff because you have to. There's stuff that you just can't cover any other way. But by and large, we'll try and stay platform neutral as much as possible.
My guests today are John Dickinson, Editor-in-Chief of Computer Life, and Ruth Stevens, Vice President of Marketing for Ziff Davis Consumer Media Group. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You know, I was still a little tickled when you said, well, that big anxiety about computers that used to be there, a lot of that is gone. And you're right. It used to be if we showed someone a computer, they used to say, I can't type.
Well, right.
Nobody can type. A few people can type. What has happened to that anxiety? Is it still there at all? Or?
There's some of it there, but it's not nearly as bad. People are, I would say to the extent that it's there, people are anxious to overcome it, whereas before they were anxious to run the other direction. And I think a lot of that has to do with peer pressure. All my neighbors have one. Comes from kid pressures. Every other kid on the block has a computer, Mom. For Pete's sakes, what's wrong with this house? Just like, you know, I remember doing that with television when I was a kid. So there's a lot of pressure from all sides for the family to buy a computer for one reason or another. And that sort of pushes people toward where, well, it's time to bite the bullet and learn how to do it. I still know 40-year-old people who've never driven a car in their life. There's a few of those around. A couple other factors that are pushing people to, you know, get into computers and get away from their anxiety is that computers are a lot less expensive today than they were, and I mean a lot less. A computer that only a couple of years ago cost $5,000 is now around $1,500, and that's a dramatic drop. And if that's not enough, all of a sudden there are so many things that you can do and so many interesting ways that you can do them with your computer that people are just kind of forced into it. You walk into a toy store and you find CD-ROMs for children. You walk into a drugstore and you'll see CD-ROM products for healthcare. It's starting to be everywhere that you look. Bookstores, of course, and record stores are starting to carry this stuff, as well as computer stores. So there's all this temptation around that I ought to be trying this out and seeing what I can do with a computer.
You guys just didn't publish a magazine. You started off first thing online. What's that about?
It's a belief that we have that more and more people are getting online. They want to communicate online, and they want to form communities online surrounding particular issues. We've proven that you can do it in the business market. We've had ZipNet around for quite a while now, about 7 years, I think. And we just basically said, okay, well, we get Computer Life up. We'll put it right up on ZipNet and see where we go. And we've got hundreds of people logging on and communicating with us. We're getting letters. We're doing forums. We're doing chat sessions scheduled with editors at various times during the week and getting quite a bit of interest online. As you know, online is a very, very hot topic. The thing that we found in our focus groups was that not as many people are on there as we would like to see, because we do think it's a really important way for us to communicate with everybody out there some of the ideas that we have. And so getting up right away online was our way of saying, hey, we're there, we're online, we're ready for you, wherever you want to come from, and tell us what you want.
To me, I think it's obvious, but maybe I'm just dead wrong. It's obvious you can't have a four-color glossy ad if you're up online. What information is online? What form is it in?
It's mostly right now in the form of text and graphics files that you can download from the service. There are surely four-color things up there, lots
really?
Of graphic files that are in four-color, and you can bring them down there in CompuServe GIF format, and there's also plenty of software to manipulate and work with those files. Some of that's online, and some of that, of course, you can buy. So there's, and then, of course, there's lots of text information that's out there.
And so in addition to this, then you can send your letters to the editor and to any of the writers. You can chat with other people who have common interests.
Yeah, you can get to us through almost any online service. We publish an internet address in the magazine as well as our CompuServe addresses for ZipNet. And yeah, you can get to us any way you want to.
It's almost like you can't just do a magazine anymore.
No. No.
It's all information and information delivery.
Right. Absolutely.
And we're striving in our online service to take the best advantage of the medium. For example, instead of simply pasting the articles from the magazine up on the online service, we are enhancing it with information and content that you couldn't get in a print magazine. For example, when an editor at Computer Life wants to give detailed software information, we can post that on the online service and readers can read about the project in the magazine and then download a template or a piece of shareware or some other thing that will help them get up to speed very quickly from downloading it.
Well, I have to say, when people talk about new magazines and technology, one magazine that usually leaps to mind is Wired. And of course, we're very good friends with the Wired people. You'll see them on here in all their various incarnations. And I'd said to Kevin Kelly, the editor who's been on here, saying, Kevin, you're such a mild-mannered guy, but with Wired magazine, every issue is hot and hip and the latest, you know. I said, I'd just be exhausted thinking about all of that stuff. And I realized that when you take on a magazine, you take on certain tasks. And, of course, at Wired, they have to be Wired, and they have to always be on that cutting edge. There had to be a set of things that you, as the editor-in-chief, had to think about going into this, about what you were dedicated to, and what part did technology play in that? This is a special interest magazine.
Well, the thing about technology that has, in my many, many years in the computer business, it's always sat home with me as being the most important thing about technology is that it's not the technology itself. It doesn't make a darn bit of difference what that technology is. It's what it can do for you. And what's really happened here is that we've gone from an era that really began in the early post-war era of computers for business and science, okay, to an era of computers for you. And the whole objective of Computer Life magazine was to build a magazine around the idea that now computers were truly personal devices. They're not quite the appliance that a microwave oven is, but they're pretty close. And the software has finally gotten to a point where, you know, all members of a family can actually do something with a computer. There's no one in a family that can't find something to do with it, whether it's just entertain themselves with a product like the JFK Assassination Disc or a game, to paying bills, to logging on and talking with friends, or logging on and finding out about genealogy tables or anything like that. And that's a whole new era. And to me, it's not an issue of style or anything else. It's an issue of being able to do stuff.
Now I'm going to ask a cheeky question. This is the premier issue. How did you manage to get 7 letters to the editor?
They actually came in. This is the truth. They actually came in with the subscription cards.
Oh, well, that's the way to do it.
Oh, sure.
I was thinking, all right, you know, are these like your cousins?
No.
You got them to write in?
No. We put a thing on the subscription card and that said, if you have something that you want us to do in computer life, write to us. And many, many people did.
Okay, the magazine just came out. You must be getting more than 7 letters now. What's been the reaction?
Generally, it's good. It's really good. People really, really like it. And in some places, it's even hard to find on those newsstands. So we're getting, I just went through about 75 messages that came in through the internet this morning. And by and large, they're really very good.
John and Ruth, thank you for joining me.
It was delightful.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks for having us.
My guests today have been John Dickinson and Ruth Stevens with Ziff Davis. John is the editor-in-chief of the new Ziff Davis magazine, Computer Life. And Ruth is the vice president of marketing for the Ziff Davis Consumer Media Group. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Cinnamon is the president and CEO of Allegra New Media, a leading publisher of CD-ROMs. I asked him to tell us about the new CD-ROM explosion.
What's been happening with CD-ROM is that for many years it was limited by the installed base of machines. In other words, there just weren't enough CD-ROM drives out there. And that was really an effect of the fact that the cost for these CD-ROM drives were very high. When I started selling CD-ROM drives back in 1988, they were running around $1,000, and that meant that the market was limited. Now, these CD-ROM drives with sound cards are out there for, in many cases, less than $100. And when people are buying new PCs, they're able to include a good CD-ROM drive and a sound card for less than $150, and that's resulted in this explosion of product out there. And it's really gotten to the point where when someone's buying a computer, it's a very easy decision to include a CD-ROM drive.
Well, I have to say that people have had their computers a while, and they've settled in, and everything's fine. They're saying, oh, CD-ROM, I really don't want to, my computer's settled in. Everyone I know who has gone to buy a computer in the last 6 months, it's like, well, you got to have a CD-ROM. So we're really seeing sort of instantly, this is what's going on. But it's not a gimmick, right?
No, absolutely not. And it's interesting when you talk about people settling into their computer system. People settle into a computer system, but then they want to try some new software. And the computer companies and the software companies are very clever in constantly making it very appealing to buy a new computer as driven by the software. So a lot of people who have had a computer for years, they have to keep upgrading to get the newest technology and put that CD-ROM drive in. And now it's gotten to the point where it's become very widespread, and it's an easy decision. People are just including it.
Well, whenever I hear somebody say, okay, it's going to get bigger and better, and I think I'm never sure whether to believe it or not. And I saw this this point here. The DataQuest said that 17.5 million CD-ROM drives will ship in 1994.
Yeah, that's kind of an amazing statistic. And I was suffering through all those market research statistics in 1987 and 88 and 89. And everybody kept saying next year is going to be the year of CD-ROM, and the year after that's going to be the year of CD-ROM. And in reality, what happened is it finally happened in 93, 94, 95, and everybody's looking back and say, gee, 17 million CD-ROM drives, that's several million more than we expected to ship in our wildest dreams. This must be the year of CD-ROM, and it's finally caught people by surprise.
Well, how many were shipped in 1993?
Well, the 17 million number, I think, is a worldwide number. But I remember seeing statistics that in 1993, the shipments were expected to be 3 or 4 million. And I think actually it turned out to be a little bit more than that.
And what about 91 and 90? I'm trying to see how fast this growth is.
You know, actually what happened is it really kind of started doubling back in 88, 89, going from 500,000 drives to 1 million drives to 2 million drives to 4 million drives to 8 million drives. And once you get up around 2, 3, 4 million, and certainly when you're up into 10, 15, 20 million, people say, gee, that's a real industry. And the other side of the coin is not only are the CD-ROM drives shipping in such a quantity, but the titles are out there, and now everybody's got them. I mean, you've got 10, 12 million people in the U.S. alone that have been using CD-ROM for the last year or so, and it's become a phenomenon.
Now, I got to stop you, and we don't usually stop and do the basic definitions, but this is the first time we really are looking at the CD-ROM explosion per se. And just everybody listening, spell CD-ROM and tell us what it is and tell us what it can do for it.
All right. I can spell CD-ROM. but what it stands for is Compact Disc Read-Only Memory. And the technology is exactly the same technology that you have in CD audio discs. And in fact, that's the reason why the drive prices have come down so rapidly, because it really is driven by consumer audio technology. And, you know, those manufacturers, I'm sure, are able to stamp out those CD-ROM drive machines for $25 to $50, and they're landing here for a little bit more than that. And then going into your IBM or Dell or Compaq computer for $100.
So actually, the consumer market in audio, instead of the old LPs, 8-tracks, cassettes, the CD market, because of the volume that's being produced, has ended up making this much cheaper in the computer sector.
Absolutely. It's driven strictly by the production lines that are being used for the audio players. Now, interestingly enough, the CD-ROM drives being used for computers are a little bit more advanced, but the volumes have finally gotten to the point right now where $100 is the magic number. And in fact, you know, you look at it, you look at the costs for the components inside a personal computer, the CD-ROM drive is no longer a major component. I mean, it costs less than the hard drive and maybe a little bit more than the floppy drives.
Now, the next question to me is, I know what a CD does for me in the audio business. I know that gets me music and anything else they might put up there. What does it do for me on a computer?
The CD-ROMs do several things for you on the computer. The first major application for the CD-ROMs as far as widespread consumer products were for games, entertainment, children's education, a category that people in many cases refer to as edutainment. And that was a very attractive thing. The reason why it was so appealing is the CD-ROMs are able to deliver lots of sound and lots of video and lots of graphics and get that information into your machine. So traditional software, as it was shipped on floppy diskette, couldn't deliver the graphics. You couldn't deliver the video. And therefore, you didn't have that wow factor. Suddenly, when CD-ROMs started becoming commonplace, people were amazed that they could see a video on their PC, and they could hear somebody talking to them, and they can look at thousands of high-resolution pictures. And that's the wow factor that's really made a difference for CD-ROM. Now, that's what's gotten people interested in the consumer and the entertainment side of it, but what we're doing at Allegro is focusing a lot more on the business applications. And you can do the same kind of things. You can provide the same amount of wow for something that's not fun and games.
My guest today is Barry Sinnemann. He's president of Allegro New Media, a CD-ROM publisher. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. What does Allegro New Media do? What are we producing here?
Allegro produces business-oriented CD-ROM titles. And these are products that range in price from roughly $50 to $100 that are available at most computer retail chains and are also available mail order that people can use in your small business, home office computer, or even at home or in larger businesses. The products that we sell help improve your productivity, help you do your job better.
Now, you have a Learn to Do series. What's that about?
Yeah, when we kind of took a step back and looked at what we could do with this technology, looked at how we could take advantage of video and of sound and of book-level content and interactivity, we saw that there was a big opportunity in creating products that could help people learn. And we weren't really the first ones to do this. In fact, the first companies were the ones that were creating products just like this for children's education. And my son's learning how to read from his computer. Maybe I'm a lousy parent, but he seems to love it so much. It's just a lot of fun. It's very interactive. And what we decided to do was come out with a series of CD-ROM titles that educated adults. The type of area that we're concentrating on first are computer-related products. So our first two titles in the series, one's called Learn to Do Windows with John C. Dvorak, and the second is called Learn to Do Desktop Publishing, are, in essence, teachers in a box.
I love seeing that great picture of our old friend John Dvorak on the front of the Learn to Do Windows 3.1, and certainly more than just business users use Windows. Are we going to see a lot of John on the inside? Is he explaining in video, or do we just see a shot here and there of John? What do you say?
There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 minutes of John's contribution to the product, whether that's in video or in audio narration. And the way he's set up in this Learn to Do title is that John's your over-the-shoulder coach. He's there to introduce you to the background of Windows, and there's a nice video of him explaining it to you. He's there to get you started with Windows and explain what you do first and explain what's in the product and how you start our product and end it and how you can navigate through. And once you're into each of the major sections of the product, John's voice is there just in the background saying, you might want to try this or why don't you try that? And, you know, of course, we have some of John's humor creeping in when you make a mistake. He's got his trademark wisecracks there, and it's pretty amusing.
You know, for a while there, it was real popular for people to send you videotapes in the package, and you'd put this in your VCR, and the CEO of the company would explain, you know, about the product and that type of thing. But this is more than that you're able to interact with these CD-ROMs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When we started to figure out what we were going to do with these products, we had a goal, and the goal was to educate people. We took a step back, and we said, well, how are people learning these skills now? Well, obviously, they're learning them by books, and you can buy a book on Windows or a book on desktop publishing, but that's very one-dimensional. I mean, it's a nice reference, but it's hard to find what you need. People are buying videotapes, obviously. You can get a $50 or $100 videotape that explains how Windows works, and it shows you some screenshots. But then you're going to have to take that home and compete with your kids on the TV, or you're going to have to watch it in your office in a conference room, and it's just not in the right place. When we really looked at it, the way people were learning these skills was either through taking a course, which can be quite expensive but is not only that interactive, but most commonly there was the hey Ed factor, the guy down the hall, the guy that was an expert in Windows that you could ask him a question. And we were able to combine all these elements, the guy that's looking over your shoulder, the videos, the instructional material, and the books on CD-ROM. And that's where the potential of the media really lies.
In CD-ROM, you can go right to one section, whereas if you've got a big, long videotape, you've got to fast forward and go back. And so in addition to everything else, you can just go and look at that one area you want, like in a book.
Exactly. Another product that we have called Business Library has three complete business videos on it. And we were quite surprised when we were finished with the product that we were actually using these videos on CD, and there was a video on direct mail by Bob Stone, which is just fascinating. We were able to look at the 30 different video clips in this video and learn exactly what we wanted, just like we were flipping through a book. You want to take a look at this segment, you can view it on the screen. If you don't understand it, you can go back and you could skip around. So in reality, what we were doing in a 40-minute videotape is you could go through it in less than 40 minutes, find what you want, and learn more effectively. And the same thing carries over onto the Learn to Do titles. You have, in essence, random access to that pictorial or video information.
Now, one thing that I'm trying to figure out when you're producing these CD-ROMs is that, well, I knew if I was producing a video, I'd get a video kind of person. And I know that if I was doing sort of a help database information thing on a floppy, say, or on a hard disk, I'd get basically a technical information type. What does it take to put one of these CD-ROMs together?
We've tried it lots of different ways, and I've been publishing CD-ROMs since 1988. And the best way we've found to do it is to work with very high-level instructional designers with very strong multimedia skills. And these are new people that are, I guess, the directors of the 90s. And these are the people that understand how to educate and teach and convey information, taking advantage of this new media. And they know how to script things, how to bring in the video content, how to create a gestalt that's really much more the sum of its parts.
The other title in the first edition of the Learn to Do series is Learn to Do Desktop Publishing. Now, that's not a single product. Windows 3.1 is a Microsoft product, but desktop publishing is a generic skill. How do you match the generic skill of learning to do desktop publishing with, you know, all these different software packages which are out there?
That's a good question. When we started to work on that project, we worked with an expert desktop publisher that's been teaching this for years. And we took a step back and we said, we'd like you to teach people desktop publishing. How do you go about doing that? And what we did is we pulled together a very, very authoritative book on desktop publishing that gave us lots of the reference and content we needed, with lots of screen captures illustrating key desktop publishing concepts, expert advice from people that have been doing desktop publishing for years, and combine those. Now, it's an interesting point about how we're trying to teach a generic skill. But one of the things that we learned as we started to do the research was that the features, the basic features of many of the desktop publishing programs on the market have all converged. And they all involve changing fonts and embedding graphic in text and changing the colors of images. And really what our challenge was to generically show people why you want to do that and how you do that. The exact way in which that's implemented in most of the products is very similar. So what happens is when you look at the product overall, it's a very good coach, a very good teacher on the principles of desktop publishing. And one of the things that you have to remember is desktop publishing is a task that doesn't happen solely at the desktop. When you're involved in creating something, a printed brochure, for example, well, you may pull in photographers, you may have to do a video shoot, you're going to have to deal with a service bureau, you're going to have to print the thing out. And this product covers all of those aspects in detail in video and sound and text.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of people who try to learn to program a computer by just reading a book on what are the elements of the language versus somehow getting to know a programmer who says, well, gee, here's the kind of problems you want to solve, and here's what you're going to run into, and be sure and talk to these people. So it's like you're giving a much broader perspective of desktop publishing.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the product is even people that have been doing desktop publishing for years don't have the entire body of acquired knowledge about desktop publishing, and they may not be experts on setting type and know the exact hints you may need when you're talking about laying out a headline, or they may not be really experts in colorizing images. But we have people on the disk who have those skills that are actually able to talk to you, and you'll click on their face and they'll say, remember to use, you'll click on their image and they'll say to you, remember that the best color contrast is black on yellow, or black on a 10% blue. Or remember that when you're setting a headline, use upper and lowercase letters. These are hints and skills that are only accumulated through experience, and we're able to condense those experiences and that wisdom onto the CD.
It's also nice you can just bring it up occasionally and kind of browse through it and say, well, back to work.
Exactly.
My guest today is Barry Cinnamon. He's president of Allegro New Media. He's also formerly the president of the Bureau of Electronic Publishing. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Well, I was looking at some of your other titles, and I was kind of amused. I see here that the Clinton Healthcare Plan is on CD. What is that?
Well, we were working on titles to release towards the end of 93, and we saw that there was a very good opportunity to inform people about the Clinton Healthcare Plan, and we had thought about doing the product when the plan was formally released in its grand 1,542-page volume. We were able to get an electronic version of that from the government, and we decided that this would be a good foundation for an interactive CD, both because we could convey lots of information other than the text, and we thought that there was a good market for it. So we began to very intently work on the project in a real crash effort, and managed within the period of 6 weeks to release the CD-ROM version of the product, which we call the Clinton Health Security Plan, What It Means and What It Costs.
So what's in it besides just the text of the health security plan?
Well, that's interesting. We knew that in order to take full advantage of the medium, we would have to include a lot more of the text. We initially had expected to get lots of video from the White House. We obviously thought, since we were there to help inform the public about the plan, that the videos that were available at the White House and which were in the public domain would be a very good adjunct to the product. And we had some of our content acquisition people begin acquiring those. At the same time, we realized that we didn't want to come out with a product that was strictly promulgating the Democratic Party line, and we were able to involve a lot of other people in the product in terms of creating some objective commentary. So about half the CD, in terms of text and video, is composed of the opposition's point of view. We were able to get video interviews from the Republican National Committee, from various healthcare providers, from the ABA, from the AMA, and from some insurance industry groups. And that really had a tendency to round out the product, and we were very, very excited about it. Unfortunately, we had all this third-party content and commentary and videos, but our acquisition people were stonewalled in terms of getting these videos from the White House, and we were very frustrated coming down to the last 3 days of working on the product to stay within our deadline. And in total abject frustration, we decided to try and get in touch with the White House directly. And mind you, we had contacted virtually everyone we can think of in Washington to get the information. One of our acquisitions people, in finally total frustration, sent a fax to Hillary Rodham Clinton requesting this formally, and just kind of informing her that we really were there trying to help and we were unable to get these videos. And cleverly, in the middle of the fax in bold letters, we included the phrase, and we got more cooperation from the Republican National Committee. And they were very, very helpful to us. Well, we sent this fax over on a Tuesday evening, and I get into the office kind of early Wednesday morning at around 7:45. I answered the phone and got a call from the White House press secretary, who identified himself, and you know, I spoke to him, and he said, please don't send any more faxes to Hillary Rodham Clinton. We'll give you anything you want. And apparently what happened is the fax did indeed land on her desk on a Tuesday evening, and she got very, very upset and picked up the fax and apparently marched across the street to the healthcare war room and asked very intensely and pointedly, why aren't you helping these people? As a result, they were phenomenally cooperative over the next few days, and we did indeed receive a lot more video than we had expected, and got very, very high quality videotapes from the White House, including the president's address to the joint session of Congress. The next day, we received some more packages from the White House by Federal Express. We got the up-to-the-minute update of the plan, and we got pictures of the Clintons and of Gore, of President, Vice President Gore, and of Mittens the cat. So they were very cooperative.
I thought it was socks. It's now Mittens?
It must have been.
You've been making these CD-ROMs since, what did you say, 1988?
Yeah.
Did your vision of what they were going to do and how they were going to be, has that changed over the years? Or is it been you saw it and it's just you had to wait for the market to catch up with you?
The vision of everyone in the industry certainly has evolved. I mean, back in 1987 and 88, when people started publishing on CD-ROM, there was no capability of delivering video, and it really wasn't even discussed. I mean, we were delighted that we were able to show a color picture on the screen. So what's really, in essence, happened is the technology that's become available over the last few years has enhanced people's visions, and it's changed their expectations. The important thing to remember about this kind of publishing is, although it's on CD-ROM right now, everything's really digital. CD-ROM's the most effective way to deliver that information and sell it to the customer. But certainly, 5 or 10 years from now, it's just as effective to send that information over a fiber optic line. And once again, that's going to cause a change in people's visions.
So you see sort of a tapering to the CD-ROM revolution when you can get them directly into your business or home over fiber optics or whatever.
It's possible that it'll change. There is a lot of talk about CD-ROMs being able to deliver 4 times as much information as they can, and certainly, without question, they're by far the most effective way to deliver that amount of information into the home. So I expect that it's going to be a very viable medium for a good 10 or 15 years.
Now, this is sort of a how big is it bigger than a bread box question. I have several of these from time to time. People know about floppy disks. How much more information can be stored on a CD-ROM versus a single floppy disk? Just ballpark.
Well, a single floppy disk holds about 1.5 megabytes of data. Your average CD-ROM holds around 700 megabytes. So you've got something that's got a capacity that's roughly 500 times more. That's one point. The second point is that you have a medium that costs less to create than that floppy diskette.
A CD-ROM is cheaper to create.
It's cheaper.
A unit, yeah.
Absolutely.
Than one floppy disk.
Cheaper to manufacture the CD-ROM.
Interesting. Why did you choose to get someone like John Dvorak to participate in this? I mean, as opposed to just do a learn-to-do Windows 3.1?
Well, we started out with the idea of doing a learn-to-do Windows 3.1 product, and actually the reason for our doing that product to begin with was that our biggest technical support problem with our other CD-ROMs was not that they couldn't use a CD-ROM, but when we dug down and quizzed these people calling us up, it turned out that they didn't understand Windows. So that was a very good reason for us to come out with this learn-to-do Windows 3.1 title, and once we started working on that, we thought it was important from a sales standpoint, from a comfort standpoint for the customers, to associate the product with someone as well-known as John. He was our first choice for an industry expert and figure, and we had actually published one of his books previously on diskette. So he was very amenable to that, and we negotiated and came to an arrangement where he would provide the expertise and some of the video and audio content. And it was very interesting how we were able to pull that together. It was something that was done entirely without a face-to-face meeting. We've met John Dvorak before, but the entire production was done remotely. So we hired a video crew and a sound crew and a camera crew, and they went to his office and took care of taking the pictures there and came up with lots of interesting shots and lots of interesting clips. Our people then integrated that back in the office and pressed it onto the CD.
So you could just do it all remotely?
We did everything remotely, and actually wasn't totally remotely. We had a speakerphone. So the speakerphone was in the studio when they were doing the shot, and we were directing it remotely. And it worked out just fine.
Well, Barry, what do you anticipate? What's next in the Learn to Do series?
Well, we have several product lines under development and that we're expanding at Allegro. We have a line of business reference titles like Business Library and Business 500, and we plan on coming out with more titles in that product line down the road. We also have a series of PC library titles. We have a product called PC Library. In the fall, we're rolling out a new title called Home PC Library. As far as new titles in the Learn to Do series, this fall we expect to release a product called Learn to Do Spreadsheets and Learn to Do Word Processing, the two other major applications that we saw out there that people would be using a lot. And of course, we have some well-known, interesting celebrities who are participating with us on those two titles.
Oh, you can tell us who they are.
No, I can't.
Barry.
It's one of those legal things, Mark.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll be waiting with bated breath, Barry. Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
My guest today has been Barry Cinnamon. He's president of Allegra New Media, the CD-ROM publisher of the new titles Learn to Do Windows 3.1 with John Dvorak and Learn to Do Desktop Publishing. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Archimedes' Mirrors.
The year was 213 BC. The place was Syracuse, a port on the Mediterranean island of Sicily, and the man was Marcellus, nicknamed the Sword of Rome. Marcellus was having a tough time of it. His mission to conquer the upstart city-state of Syracuse was in trouble. True, history would later record that they had picked the wrong side in Rome's war with Carthage, but right then the citizens of Syracuse were proving tougher and more resourceful than Marcellus had anticipated. One particular citizen of Syracuse contributed mightily to his headache, Archimedes. The 75-year-old mathematician helped delay the overthrow of his city for at least a year by designing several effective war machines, including huge catapults for firing boulders and great cranes to lift boats out of the water. The most curious and controversial of Archimedes' inventions, however, were his mirrors. According to 12th-century historian Johannes Zonaris, Archimedes burned up the whole Roman fleet by tilting a kind of mirror towards the sun and kindled great flames which he directed at the ships that lay at anchor, and thus consumed them all. Fact or fiction? Although it sounds more like 20th century Star Wars technology, an English physics teacher thought it a curious enough tale to warrant further investigation. He went through the exercise to see whether it would be feasible to set fire to a wooden ship with mirrors. While a concentrated solar beam can ignite wood, you may have proved this for yourself as a kid playing with a magnifying glass, the problem is that sunlight reflected from a mirror gets dispersed over distance. Assuming that the ships were 50 yards from the mirrors, any closer and they'd have been too easy a target, and that each mirror was 1 yard square, the teacher showed that 500 polished brass mirrors would have been needed to set a ship on fire. 500 mirrors, each held in place by a soldier, all 500 soldiers aiming at the same spot on the same ship. Such perfect coordination sounds too implausible. So, what did Archimedes do that might have given rise to the legend of setting the ships on fire? Most likely, he helped organize a battery of catapults which hurled Greek fire, that is, flaming pitch and sulfur, at the Roman ships. Perhaps the results of such an airborne barrage were so impressive that later writers were inspired to create the legend of the mirrors. As it turned out, all Archimedes' inventiveness was for naught. A year later, during the Feast of Diana, when most of the citizens of Syracuse got drunk, the Romans overran the city. And although Marcellus gave specific orders that freemen were to be unharmed, old Archimedes was killed during the invasion. According to the story, he was drawing geometrical figures in the sand in front of his house when a Roman soldier interrupted him. Archimedes impatiently waved the man away, at which point the enraged soldier killed him. He's been dead for 2,200 years, yet Archimedes lives on in history. Too bad that one of the best stories about him, setting fire to the Roman fleet with mirrors, doesn't stand up to the scrutiny of modern physics.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.